So, were you relieved when you found out you were going back early?
We weren't upset. It had been really interesting there, and there were lovely, lovely people that we worked with. They came from all over the world, the people in the office building. There was the office building on the corner, and the building, the two buildings next to it, one on the side and one at the end of a little round, it was a little inset off the main street. What do you call it? I can't think of the word, but you call a little round street, and it had five buildings on it, one on each side on the corner of the main street, and then two sideways facing buildings and one facing out to the opening of the. And the two buildings were where all the people lived who worked in the third one on the corner. And so we all got to know each other pretty well, and they were from all over the world, and they were all fairly special sort of people. Quite a few of them had been in prison camps and had numbers tattooed on their arms and things like that. You felt a bit overawed by some of them there. One of our favourite people was a Frenchman called Claude, who'd been hiding in the mountains. And he had been working in the city in the, I think it was a radio, the central radio building for France, for Paris. And the workers went on strike over something. I don't know the details. And they decided that what they would do is switch the power off in the building. And it was his job. They decided he was the one who would actually switch the power off. And so he lost his job immediately and had to go and hide in the mountains because they were after him for having turned the power off for the whole radio system of Paris. And he was a very, at the stage we knew him, he was extremely overweight. And I used to think, how does he hide behind a tree? size of three trees, you know. But I guess by the during the war, he wasn't quite so big. But his wife had been in the prison camp, and she had a number tattooed on her arm, and she was a very sickly lady because of what had been done to her in the camp. They'd done various, you know, chemicals
Oh my
tests on
gosh.
her, and it had completely destroyed her innards. So she was a fairly quiet lady, and he was very, very outgoing, a gorgeous man, and he used to always wear a big coat with lots of pockets, like a raincoat, but lots of, like a gabardine raincoat, you know, with lots of pockets, and he would always have some pieces of fruit in his pocket, and if you bumped into him in the street, he would pull out an apple from one pocket and give it to one of the kids, and an orange from another pocket and give it to the other kid, you know.
Oh, lovely.
And so to them, he was this wonderful man, lovely, kind, friendly man who always had fruit for them and so on. And years later, when we went back to Vienna in 1970, and like 20 years later, we went and visited. When we were in France, we went and visited Claude and Gabby, and he was still wildly overweight, but he'd had a lot of illness because of that, and he smoked like a train, and he said to us, "Well, I've been in hospital and I've seen the doctors, and they told me I had to give up wine and food and cigarettes. Well, I figured that two out of three is pretty good." So he was still eating the food. But in fact, he was being a bit careful about what he was eating, but he still ate a lot, you know.
Yeah. So what
So
year was it when you left Vienna?
We went there in September 1958, and we left in the Christmas, just after, I think, or in at Christmas time of 1959.
And where did you go from Vienna?
We bought a car while we were there, which was a right-hand drive car because we were going to take it back to New Zealand. And there were some funny things happened about that. But we drove through Austria and through Italy to Genoa. Yeah, to where the boat, the Italian migrant ship heading for Australia was going to pull in there. And we went and stayed in a little rooming house in the town, and Jim took the car down to the wharf and watched while it was being loaded onto the boat to see that it got there safely. And a guy who came and talked to him, started to talk to him about what was happening, and Jim said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't speak Italian." And the guy said, "But I'm speaking to you in English." Jim hadn't recognised it, and we became good friends with him, actually, and yeah, on the trip.
You loaded your car onto the boat there?
Yeah, and then it was another day or two before the ship actually took off, and it was a migrant ship bringing loads and loads of young men out to Australia where they thought they were going to earn lots of money and send back money to the family, and then hopefully enough for the fares for various family members to come back to follow them.
Well, it did work for some, didn't it?
It did. Oh, yeah, and a lot of them. I mean, this guy who spoke to Jim, he was on his return. He'd been to Australia some years earlier. And I found out later that he'd actually been here during the war in a prison camp in Australia, because he was Italian, but he didn't mention that, and he'd gone back to Italy to marry a lady, and a lot of them got married, because they were arranged marriages with somebody in their village, you know, whether she was someone he already knew or not, I don't know, but he'd been back and visited her and married her. And then he was going back to earn some more to be able to bring her out to live with him, which he later did.
Yes.
And later, Linda found a report about him in much more recent papers in about the 70s or 80s or something, where he led a campaign in Melbourne. There was one area that lots of migrant families had settled, not far out of town, and the government had decided to widen the road, the main road, and knock down all these houses. And he led a campaign to try and save the houses, but they failed. And that's where I learned his history.
Okay. So how was the trip back with your three kids? And how long did it take?
A bit exciting. Well, it must have been 6 weeks. I don't know, at least a month. There was a ceremony when New Year's Day came, and there was another ceremony when we crossed the equator, where they painted people up with shaving cream and stuff and threw them in the pool on the ship. There was this little pool that was about 15 feet square, or three or four metres square, and very deep. There was no shallow end, and once you're in it, you were swimming, you know, or yeah, hanging on to the side. And I was surprised to find that on the whole, Italians couldn't swim, and because there's coastline all around. You know, there's lots of towns that are on the beach in Italy, but they didn't swim. And so they either stood at the side sat at the side and watched the people who did get in, or they got in the water and clung on the side. And we were about the only ones who sort of swam across it and things, you know, swam around in it. But they threw all these people in anyway because we were crossing the equator, and they gave us all a certificate saying we'd crossed the equator. which I've still got somewhere. Yeah, but, and people, again, very few people. This guy Tony spoke English, and a few others did, but on the whole, they didn't, and Tony did lots of translation. We spent our time with a group of young Italians all the time. There were people from all over Europe. I remember there was one very plump young Hungarian who looked about 25, and he told us proudly how he was never going to work in his life again, never going to do another day's work. He would find some old lady who ran a rooming house, and he would take a room in her house, and she would feed him, and he wouldn't bother paying any rent, because when she complained, he would persuade her not to complain, and they would be all right. He wouldn't need to work ever again, and he would find ways of making a bit of money here and there. People are very, naive. You can always make money out of them, he said. You know, you're a real nasty piece of work.
Yeah.
You often wonder what on earth became of those people.
Where did you arrive? Was it Australia or New Zealand?
First, we landed first in Perth. The ship pulled into Perth. And all of these young blokes were going to jump off the ship and go and find work. And we knew, before we left Europe, we knew that Australia had no work. Everybody was desperately out of work. And we watched on the wharf, after we left Genoa, we went further down the coast to another large town, and we took on more people there, and then we went to this island where, I think it's where Mount Etna is, and we were off the ship for a day there while they loaded on a whole lot of people and a whole lot of stuff, and we went, the entire town was overlooked by a massive church on the top of the hill, and we decided to walk up to the church and because it would have a good lookout from there, and then back again. And all the way up this street, there were little shacks built, just literally one-room shacks built against the wall of the church, which was on the side of a mountain, you know. And it was just a laneway, and out of each of these things came a drain, which went into a drain down the laneway where everything fluid flowed. Everything. It was disgusting, the whole place. And as we walked up there, people kept saying, "Americani," and spitting on the ground. We basically would keep walking, but when we decided to buy a pair of shoes for the baby in one shop, and the bloke had his son speaking English, translating for him. His son was about 13. This son, when we said we spoke English, the son said, "Americani." And we said, "No, Australian." And Jim sort of clenched his fist and said, "Lavore, worker." And he said, "Oh, right." So we bought the thing. So when we got back to the ship and got on board, and off we went from there, it was, but on the wharf, there were all these people dressed in full black mourning, both on the ship and on the wharf. And everybody was sobbing their eyes out, saying goodbye to the young men. And some of the people on the ship were actually families, and they were all dressed in complete mourning as well, because they were leaving home. And the men, the young blokes, carried a little attaché case, and that was their luggage. They were going to this wonderful country where everything would be wonderful, you know. And we knew that they wouldn't find work. when they got there. And so I was weeping as well, along with all the rest of them. So when we got to Fremantle, we said, you know, when you get off the ship, go straight to the union headquarters and ask them what work there is here, because we don't think you'll find work here. And then we found out where the union headquarters was, and they went there and were told, no, don't stay here, there's no work in Western Australia, go to Melbourne. And the next stop was Melbourne. And the same thing, we were going on to Sydney, because that's where the ship to New Zealand went to. And so at Melbourne, the same thing happened. They went to the union headquarters and they said, there's no work here, go on to Sydney. And so they did, and they had to get off. That was the end of the ship's trip in Sydney, but they had to get off then. And most of them ended up in the sugarcane fields in Queensland, cutting sugar. But there were some lovely people among. One was a gorgeous bloke called Rosario Bogota, and he ended up living in Queen Street, Norwood.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah. And so I tried and tried to find, when we came here, it was 20 years later, you know, every time I met someone Italian, I'd ask them, do you know a bloke called Rosario Bogota? And eventually someone said, yes. They said he went back to Italy. So I never heard from him again. We wrote to each other for a lot of those years in between, you know, we wrote. He always sent me a beautiful religious card for Easter and one for Christmas and so on. And a little note in it, you know, we used to send back a letter. But once he'd gone back to Italy, I didn't know where he was. So that was the end of that.
So you landed in Sydney and then got on the ship back to New Zealand?
The ship back, yeah, the Wanganella. And my mother had got on the Australia in Melbourne and travelled to Sydney with us, so that we had that little time to get a few days to get there. And then she went back by train back to Melbourne.
So where did you go when you arrived back in New Zealand?
Well, we went and stayed again with Jim's mother and sister. From there, we went to up north to a place called Kaikoi, which is the second northernmost town, big town in New Zealand. And Grace and Len were living there. Len was teaching at Northland College, and Jim got a job at the college as well. So they both were teaching there together, and Grace and Len were living about 15 miles out of town in a little tiny village. They lived in a house that had three bedrooms, and they had four children, and we had three children, and it was a bit crowded. And so we went looking for somewhere to live. We would drive around the whole area each weekend looking to see if we could find any sort of place to live in. And we found a farm about 15 miles the other side of Kaikoi, where they had a sharemilker's cottage that wasn't being used at that stage. And it was a beautiful new house, three-bedroom house. It had a shower. First time we had a shower. And they were lovely people, and we stayed there. But then Roger had started school there, and Jenny was about to start school. And so we were looking for somewhere in the town, and we eventually found a tiny little house right in the town that we could rent. And we called it our matchbox. And we lived in that for a couple of years. And Jim came home from school one day. There were some new houses being built down one of the side streets. And he said, one of those is a schoolhouse, and the principal said, it's for us. And I said, I'll believe it when I see it. I didn't believe anything this bloke said. He was a strange guy. And I had to eat my words because it was our house. We lived in that for about a year and it was lovely. We went off from there to another town called Otorohanga.
And was this moving all because of Jim's jobs or was it more to do with the activism?
A bit of each, actually, because the further north you went in New Zealand, the more race, the larger the percentage of the population was Maori and the worse the racism got. And at that stage in Kaikoi, most of the Maori people lived outside the town on any bit of land they could find. There'd be a little shack, might have a dirt floor, and just one room, no electricity, no running water, and they would have one bed that everybody slept in, big, you know, a big double bed, and they would have a small table that was probably outside the building, and they would have fruit boxes to sit on for chairs, and they would have kerosene lanterns for light. And they would wash their clothes in the local stream and hang them all along the fence wires, the wire fence of the farm, to dry. And it was pretty good, you know. And the kids from used to get the school bus into town, into school, and very few of them made it through school. They would, to the end, you know, they would get a job working on a farm somewhere or whatever. But while they were still at school, they were doing their homework on the table by the light of the kerosene lantern. So they found it hard to actually get through the work, you know. There were a few bloody brilliant kids who made it through, and they got what was in New Zealand, they called it university entrance, UE. And at the end of Form 5, you sat for the equivalent of matric, and they would get university entrance and they'd be able to go off to Auckland to go to university. And then they had no family support there at all. And the Maori people worked very much, Maori family support was a big thing in their lives, you know. They would find it very difficult. So quite often they wouldn't make it through university. Some of them did and became strong leaders in their people, you know, in their struggle. 60, 61 and 62 we were there, and then we moved from there to Otorohanga at the beginning of 63.
And how long were you there for?
We were there only for just under 2 years because Jim then got a job teaching at the Teachers College in Auckland. And we'd been very happy in Otorohanga, actually, but we went off to Auckland from then on. We were in Auckland.
And were you still maintaining all your activism?
Well, up north we were involved in the Maori work in situation, trying to help people there. I remember once we went through our whole wardrobe and picked out all the clothes that were decent that we didn't use much, you know. And Jim was helping one particular family and he took these clothes there and they had a photo taken of the entire family all wearing our clothes. And it was pretty funny to see all this whole family all dressed in our clothes. Not that they knew that, really, you know, we just said these are some clothes that we've got. While he was there, I don't know whether I've already talked to you about the Kaikoi Family Advice and Guidance Scheme. We became friendly with the man who was the head of Social Security, which was like Centrelink. And he was in charge of looking after their condition, how they were getting on and stuff. and he was a wonderful man doing a wonderful job. And another person who was there was the only Maori doctor in New Zealand, was in Kaikohe. And those two had dealt with these people in one way or another. They'd been helping the people who were suffering, you know. And Jim joined with them. The three of them set up this scheme called the Kaikohe Family Advice and Guidance Scheme, which still exists. It was taken over in the end by the government. It called something slightly different, but it's the same organisation. What they had was that people, they would go and see people who were doing it hard, and they would say to them, look, would you like a bit of a hand working out how to deal with the money, the little bit of money you get, how to cope? And if they said yes, then they joined this scheme. And some person would, or some family would take on another family to help them get through life. And some, and one of the people in the helping family would be responsible for sitting with them each week and going through their finances. And they worked out a chart that had to be filled in each week, where they worked out how much was going to be spent on rent and how much on this bill and that bill and the other bill, you know, electricity and whatever. And they made sure that there was always a small amount put aside for them to have to spend however they liked, whether it was on beer or cigarettes or just going to the pictures or whatever they wanted. They could choose to do with that money what they liked, because we knew otherwise people could never stick to it, you know, if they didn't have something to make life a bit cheery. So that went on for the rest of the time that we were there, for the couple of years. And so we became known as Nigger Lovers. And there was one bloke on the staff who was an absolute religious nutter. He used to walk up and down the main street on late night shopping, was on Fridays, and he'd walk up and down the main street when everybody was at the shops wearing sandwich boards saying, the end of the world is coming, all the rest. And he would stand on one corner and shout out a religious sermon to anyone who would stop and listen. But he was one of the people teaching the children. And it turned out, we found, when we went to Otorohanga, we found out that he had sent a letter to the education department about this dangerous man called Jim Gale and the things he was teaching children. It went round the town at one stage. You know what Jim Gale's teaching our children? He's teaching them that we're all descended from fossils. The girl next door had grown up in Kaikohe and gone. Her education was at Kaikohe's school system, you know, and her mother told her that Jim Gale was teaching the kids that we're all descended from fossils. And I said to her, do you know what a fossil is? And she said, no. I said, well, it's a rock, you know, where the trace of some creature is embedded in the rock. And so she said, oh, and her husband was called Jim as well. He said, next time Jim's doing the garden, I better tell him not to throw that rock away. It might be my grandfather, you know. things were pretty grim there. The principal was also very religious. He used to preach in the church every, not every Sunday, but most, you know, every other Sunday. So he'd give the sermon in the Baptist church. And he thought that these Gale brothers were pretty dangerous people and didn't quite know how to handle them. Yeah, life was pretty grim there. And yeah. Grace and Lynn had got a job in Auckland, and so they took off after 2 years. And we were there for one more year, and Jim kept applying for jobs elsewhere and not getting them. And he couldn't understand why he never you know, he had good qualifications and so on. Then he got the response from the principal at Otorohanga that he would like us to come for an interview. And so we drove. Otorohanga was about, I don't know, 500 miles away, a long way away. And so we drove down there, and he said, well, this letter came along with your application. The applications had to go through the education department. You didn't apply straight to the school. And so the education department had added in a copy of what this man had written. And they, every time Jim's applications were sent to school, so was this letter. And that's why he hadn't been getting any responses. And this guy said, well, look, I believe in working out for myself how people are. And if you understand that you are in no way allowed to bring politics into your classroom, I'm willing to give you the job. And Jim said, look, I believe too that politics, a teacher's politics shouldn't be taken into the classroom. And I can tell you that I belong to three organisations in Kaiko. I belong to the Kaikoi Soccer Club. I belong to the Kaikoi United Nations branch. And I belong to the Kaikoi Advice and Guidance Scheme. And if you think any of them are dangerous organisations, then I don't want to come here. So we got the job and we went to Otorohanga, which was really nice, a nice place.
Oh, that's lovely.